thinking about the puzzle quote that you had earlier. Like, for some people, it's like maybe doing puzzles really calms me down or relaxes me. And I've said forever, one of my favorite shows of all time is Home Improvement. However, when it comes to making mistakes, I feel very much like Tim the Toolman Taylor, right? Catches on fire, I break stuff. That's just my thing. not very handy, like, whatsoever. In fact, like, as many times as I can hire a handyman for the simplest of jobs, I will do it. The best example I have of thinking that I could tackle something and then couldn't do it was when we weren't super broke, but we didn't have a lot of money. This is just my wife and I, shortly after we bought our first house. And so I remember it was just hotter than hell. We had a torch down style roof, which in Washington doesn't seem like it's all that common. I don't know if it's common. And, like, do you know what a torch down roof looks like? Doesn't have shingles on it. It's totally flat.
Oh, okay. No. Yeah, I didn't know.
So there's no shingles. There's nothing really to absorb temperature. So when it was cold, it would get really cold. And when it would get, you know, if it was, I remember there were some summer days where outside it would say 80 degrees. And then you go inside and the thermostat is like 99. Like, it would just, it, you know, you're just getting torched all the time. So we didn't have central air and we didn't have an air conditioner, you know, but like, it just, I just felt like I can't even buy like a portable one that's $400. I just cannot do it, regardless of I'm sleeping 1 hour a night and I'm sweating all over myself and I just can't. My dogs are, they're pugs, so they already have, like, you know, the smush faces, and so, but I just can't do it. So I found these plans on this website, like this DIY website, which was how to make your own air conditioner. And so some of the things to get, it was like one of those big circular fans, and then you get a styrofoam cooler, you fill it with ice and water, and then you buy a a fish tank pump, and then you're getting some copper plumbing line, and the thought is that you're spiraling the copper line up against the fan, and the copper is also connected to a tube that is going into the fish tank with the pump. The whole thought is that you're getting icy condensation on that copper wire and the fan is pushing that cold air towards you. So I make this thing for, you know, $25 or $30 or something. And
I'm impressed.
It didn't work. So be impressed, impressed as you want. I'm
impressed that you did it. Yeah. I mean,
I
hired somebody to look into it.
Well, right. I could have, but then I'm paying a billable hour for somebody to come out.
Oh, right.
So, you know, this thing, you know, newsflash, it did not work. And my wife actually still talks about this because it's one of my, like, more, I have a few moments like this, but where I, like, thought that something was going to work and then it just totally crashed and burned. I'm like, well, now I'm out $30. I've made this big mess. I'm really agitated. And I went and bought the air conditioner anyway. And it was the best investment, like, I could have ever made.
But, you know, look, spending that $30 and doing that experience got you to buy it. And I mean, I really am a big proponent of this. Sometimes you need to have a certain experience.
Yeah, totally. Well, I did a similar thing when I didn't want to pay $30 for somebody to, or $40 for my motorcycle oil to get changed. So this was one of the first bikes I ever bought, and I do pretty much all my own maintenance now, just because I've gotten pretty good at it after just a lot of, you know, trial and error, and I actually find it kind of fun now, as aggravating as it can be sometimes. Like, it is very fun to me now. But I went to secure the bolt back into the bottom of the oil pan, and I stripped it out, like, out of the bottom of the engine. So I had to get this motorcycle towed to a dealer at 11 o'clock at night because there was no way I was going to be able to turn it on the next day because I'd fry the engine within it being on for 1 minute, right? Yep. So there's a lot of instances like that. However, where this story is going is that it was probably only like 2-3 months into me being in just constant agony all the time. My body was just so... I was in so much pain. It was like, this was post shoulder surgery. I thought I had cleared all my health issues, and then my shoulder got better, and then my back and my neck and my hands and my arms and everything just started to hurt. You know, I it's weird because I'm a weightlifter, and at the time I was still lifting, and there's these, they're called blocks. Anybody that does CrossFit or weightlifting will know what I'm talking about, but it's, they're called weightlifting blocks. And the idea is that the bar, instead of being rested on the floor and you're lifting from the floor, the blocks elevate the bar. So you're lifting from, like, your knees, or you're lifting from, like, your mid thighs. The idea is you're just getting a different stimulus because it's at a different height. You're generating all the power from your knee as opposed to from the ground. So, to buy these is like $500, $600. So again, I'm like, not spending the money to do that. So I found some great plans to do it. And I got these plans and I was making them And they turned out fantastic. Like, it only took one. It took one try. I sat in the garage with Ben and Jerry's, and I made these blocks. And I shit you not, not only was I completely out of tension, but the next day I had like a really big flicker in my lats, like on my mid back, and all my pain completely dissolved, completely. And I just thought, like, oh, my immediate thought was that I must have had a disc out of place or something that suddenly like popped into place, and then all my pain went away and all my musculature went back to where it should be. I was like, huh, that's really weird. And a couple weeks went by, and then I had an aggravating event with Zoe in the car, and I had a spasm in my neck and all my pain came back. And so I thought, oh, well, that disc just went right back into the wrong place.
Right, right. So you're carrying that narrative around with you.
Yeah. So that went around for 9 more months before I saw a doctor that said, I don't care about your imaging stuff. Like, what's your life like, and what's your stress level like, and your family and your career and all that stuff. So I had that for 9 months, thinking I'm so fragile that if I just turn my head one way to pick a shoe up off the ground, I'm going to go into spasm and my whole body's going to shut down.
That's a great doctor, by the way. Just putting the plug for him.
She's wonderful. And, she's not a TMS doctor, and she's offered to be interviewed on my podcast, and I'm going to do it at some point. It's just, it's not super convenient, but she's the head of the Huskies football team, the University of Washington Huskies football team.
So important that we have doctors like her though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole reason I reached out to her was because there was a story on the news about two chimps that got in a fight at the zoo, and that they had brought her in to do the ACL surgery. And the entire news story was about her saying, yes, he has a torn ACL, but surgery is not going to make him better. If we can just get him a place to rest and not be around all the other primates, then he's going to heal and he's going to be fine. And I kept going to people that, you know, surgeons do surgery. So I kept going to surgeons, and she's an orthopedic surgeon. And so I had thought, yeah, but she, you know, I've had all these guys say you need to get a neck surgery or a pec surgery. And I thought, okay, I go to her and she'll say that you don't need a surgery. That's what I wanted to finally hear.
Yeah, right.
But it ended up, you know, it ended up blasting off into being something completely different. But there's interesting, the handyman stuff. Like, just a few weeks ago, I had a faucet that was on the fritz and leaking all, you know, I opened up our, under the cabinet under our sink, and there's water pouring out. It's like, I mean, it's like Home Alone with the wet bandits. And, the plumber had offered to replace it. It was looking to be like $900. I was going, it's a faucet. Like, why is it so expensive?
Yeah.
I text my wife. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it. Cause I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. I can't do it. And she's like, no, it'll be fine. She's like, the nicest sink I found at Home Depot is $200. Just go buy that. And like, we'll figure it out. And so, she gets home that night, and like, I have the thing almost installed. But I ended up, I replaced the faucet that night. I also replaced all the valves under the sink, turned them from plastic into steel ones, and went off without a hitch, and it works just great. I remember after that thinking like, oh, I don't know. It should have been a very aggravating task, but I'm like, I feel really fucking good. Like,
yeah, but see, that relates. First of all, you are a lot handier than you are. So, but because I don't know if I could do that. But I believe I can figure it out.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's the point. You need to feel I can do it. I can do it is a really, it's elementally a key phrase. And I think that's how you felt. You felt powerful, you know, and we can feel powerful in all kinds of ways. You know, I'm having the experience. I'm actually having the experience right now. I think I mentioned to you that I have this this streaming network that we're trying to get up and running. And one of the reasons that I want to do it is so that we can have a show on TMS where I bring this to, I want to spread the word more. But I have to do certain tasks in this that I didn't believe I could do, you know, like, oh, how am I supposed to, okay, I'm going to go talk to people about spreading the word. It's like, I almost feel bad asking people for this. And but I had to get to a point where I could believe it. And so I actually, one of the first mornings that I was thinking, okay, I'm going to reach out to some people about this, I got totally depressed. I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's not going to work, you know. And then I started doing it, and I felt great because I let myself be powerful in a new way. So that's part of the how also. You know, we were talking about, okay, how do you address TMS? I have certain buckets that I that I utilize. And one is, how do we deal with emotions? Another is, how do we deal with doubts? Another is, how do we foster a sense of power? And if we can get people to feel powerful and happy and not full of doubts and at peace and aware, this is a tall order, but it's doable and we have time to do it. So I actually also, you know, we have a conundrum. We have many conundrums in the TMS field, as any field does. But one of the conundrums that I've run into is, how do we help people at all levels of things? And that can include, what if they can't afford to go to see anybody? We've got to have some resources. So I actually developed, I just wrote up a sheet. It's actually probably, I think, 11 pages. It's like an 11-page manifesto on how to deal with TMS. So if you're interested in me sending that to you, Eddie, so that your listeners can get a hold of that, I'm all for it. I'm not in this for anything other than spreading the word and helping people.
Is it done?
That part's done. My book is a whole different story, and that my book is all about all of the doubts that can come up and how that it basically, as I see it, it's an argument that makes it so that if you have a doubt, it's in that book. I'm gonna try not to miss any.
Make sure you have an index too, because I think something easily referenceable when it's written in such a way where the whole idea is eliminating doubt. That's one thing that
really good point.
I can't remember if Sarno's books had an index, but there wasn't one, or it wasn't a very thorough or good one. Adam Heller's book on this stuff had a really great index. Because one thing I think that would be the mind-body prescription, I got better by this point, but a lot of times, like when I get friends of mine, or yeah, I'll say friends of mine, there's a couple ones recently that have had these symptoms pop up that one of them, I mean, she's had it going on for a year, and I'm trying to think about, gosh, I really want to help her, but I don't want to be this fucking weirdo that's recommending this thing that sounds so out there. But I'm like, you know, I care enough about her well-being that I'm going to put my best foot forward. And if she thinks I'm nuts, it's fine. Luckily she took it very seriously, but a lot of times I don't know. I have a tough time remembering which of these books is the best thing, because unfortunately the way that it works a lot of times is, like, if you have a wrist problem, which in her case it's a wrist problem, healing back pain, even if it does talk about wrists inside, inherently you just read that and you think, yeah. So I usually will recommend the mind body prescription because he goes by section, but there's some that just aren't there.
Right. Yep. Same with me. No, I have certain books that I recommend based on different things. You know, that's the thing where the answer depends isn't a bad thing. It's only a bad thing if we say depends and then we walk away and we don't offer any help or guidance. But if it depends, but there are specific things we can do, then it's a good thing because we get specific about what you need. So for people who don't like to read a ton and just want the really quick version of it, Mind Over Back Pain, his first book, is a really short one. And particularly with back pain, that's a great one. Healing Back Pain has some updated things. So sometimes, you know, if somebody's not that resistant to doing the reading, I might give them that one. If there's specific questions like, well, but my pain really correlates with this physical thing, so I need that answer. That to me is a mind-body prescription problem. If somebody is having symptoms that are maybe not musculoskeletal and they need a more expansive view, I talk about the divided mind. If people need to hear an inspiring story of recovery that will really change the way they think about things. Have you read You Are the Placebo, Joe Dispenza book?
So maybe set me straight here. I can't remember if it was that one or if it was a different one, because he's got a few books. I started to read something that he wrote, and then I came across this, you know, the skeptic in me, right? This was a long time ago. It was probably 2.5-3 years ago. The skeptic in me went and said, well, what the hell is this Joe Dispenza guy even from? So I started reading up on some of his background, and I found out that he had at one point in time funded this thing that was sort of a cult. And so I was like, nope, fuck it, not reading it, and actually returned it, because you could still return things to Kindle if you got it within, I don't know, it was like 24 hours or something. Yeah. So set me straight if I'm totally wrong on that guy.
Right. Yeah. Well, listen, in terms of setting you straight on that, I actually didn't know that. So maybe you're setting me straight. But I will say this. First of all, skepticism is good. We do not want solutions that are based on blind faith. That's really it's a bad setup for everybody because you're not going to get the right answers. So I encourage people to be as skeptical as they can possibly be, actually. I think in reading what I did of Joe Dispenza, I think that a lot of what he wrote is incredibly powerful and accurate. So, you know, I don't know what was going on with this cult-like thing, but I will say this. There are people who are crazy in some areas of their lives, and they're great in others. And I think as long as you hold to that your skepticism is not only allowed, but it's valuable, it will get you to the right answers. Don't stop asking questions. Don't stop pushing against things. I tell people, tear my theory to shreds. I want you to do it. I want you to try. And it's not because I'm overconfident about it. It's because I know I can't help them if I don't address their skepticism in a real way. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's bringing to mind, there was somebody posted this in she posted it in my group. Okay. This listener, and I went and I read this thread, and a couple times I started writing something as a comment. There was 485 comments. So at the time there's probably 700 now. And a couple times I'd start to write it, I deleted because I was like, I don't know if I want to enter that storm. But PBS on their Facebook page posted it was a follow-up to a show that they did on migraines and how it was something about, you know, basically we've gotten better at diagnosing, but we haven't gotten, there's a great book called Diagnosed about this exact thing. But we've gotten better on like diagnostics, but we haven't gotten any better on cures, not just with migraines, but on a ton of different things. And there were people commenting that, you know, I've tried this. I have neck surgery. It's a hormone issue. It's a, you know, just stop eating dairy. Like there was all these suggestions, and then inherently somebody would give a suggestion and then 100 people would crush that person on the suggestion that they gave. It's my migraines are real and my, you know, I don't eat dairy and I still have all these migraines. So it was like one person had posted, they didn't say anything about Sarno or any of this stuff, but they had just made a mention of calming the nervous system, was how they had put it. And that person got eviscerated by more people commented on that particular one than anything else that was posted on there. So it's like, I don't know if I want to spend my Thursday doing this.
Right. We have to pick our audiences, and I have different conversations I have with different levels of acceptance. Yeah. You know, I might just kind of gently float it out there. And if they smack me backwards, I'm like, okay, I'll only do more harm than good if I push further than the person's comfortable with. But I also have the experience that if I can just hold fast to that, look, I'm talking about something that relates to science and logic, that honors what the person is thinking about, that welcomes skepticism, and that I have come to believe in from many, many different angles, and there's reasons for it. And, you know, then I can feel like, all right, I can float these ideas out there. And see. And sometimes I've found that I'll float an idea out there and they're totally skeptical, reject it. And 9 months later or something like that, they'll come to me and say, you know what? I continue to think about what you said. And I think there might be something to it because I had this experience. And then they get there. So you plant a seed, and it's kind of similar to how you focus on awareness during the day, seed for awareness at night. I think we need to not be afraid to just be ourselves. And I want to jump back to toxic masculinity, actually, because toxic masculinity, it's one of these PC phrases that people throw around sometimes for good and sometimes not for good. But I do think that there is something to it. There's an aggression that can be brought by men that is often about shutting down the ability to be ourselves. And that comes from self-hatred in them. And I think that we always need to be fostering that you're allowed to be you. And one thing I love about, you know, my TMS work is it's all in line with that. It's not about, oh, I've got the answers. It's actually about, no, you're going to have the answers. I can help you find them. I can help you articulate your questions. I can help you get them answered until you feel comfortable with it. And that way, we don't have to be afraid about dialogue. Toxic masculinity shuts down dialogue. There's many things that shut down dialogue, but that's one of them.
I think that maybe as somebody listened to that thing that you just said, because I know that I have felt this before, is that you sort of get to a point where, because I mean, presumptively, people that are listening to this that have that know about this kind of stuff, and you know, they've spent some amount of time in pain, and for that amount of time, they've also spent an amount of time going from doctor to doctor to doctor to specialist to, you know, chiropractor to whatever. And so there's been so much time where they've kind of been in this very high alert reaction-esque phase of their life. And then they learn about the TMS stuff, and if they don't grasp it right away, meaning like their pain goes away right away, I feel like they kind of go through this lull of a large amount of time where, you know, they try journaling and self-expression and things like that. And so I think after a while, it's easy at that point to look in the mirror and go, I don't even know who I am anymore. You know what I mean? Like right. I'm trying to be true to myself, but what even is that? Because it's been so long since I had no pain and I knew what that person was like. And like, I just know that that's the case.
Right. I felt completely altered as a person during those years. And honestly, I'm not the same person I was even after. You know, I'm better in a lot of ways, but I felt different. And I did not, I felt like I'm losing who I was. So that really rings true what you're saying. And I think to me, that's another reason why it's so important to put doubt as a concept out there. Because you can not only get back to who you were, you can get back to a more clarified version of it. You know, for instance, I fought through the TMS and got through my doubts and resolve my symptoms. You know, I have flare-ups every once in a while, but that's just the body talking. But it's not like I'm a different person than I was. I'm the same person I was, but even stronger. You know, like when I was in elementary school, I was a kid who would look out for anybody. If somebody was getting bullied, I wasn't particularly good at speaking up in such a way because I was, I think, afraid to take it on in some way. But I would be the kid who would come over afterward and say, "Are you okay?" And, you know, when I was struggling with back pain and I felt like people were not particularly empathic, didn't understand, I got into a really bitter, bad place. I wouldn't say that I became not nice. I still asked people if they were okay, but my heart wasn't in it as much. I felt really lost, and I've come back to, I'm the same person. But now I'm the person who will not only come over and say, "Are you okay?" afterwards. I'll say in the moment, "Hey, look at what you're making them feel." I now will intervene because I feel more powerful, and my body guided me to that. You know, what our symptoms are saying, as painful and as awful as they are, if we can strike the bargain of A, we're going to make them go away so you don't have to continue suffering, but B, we are going to take their message, then we're better off.
The power thing is really interesting because when I envision just power as a word, I see somebody walking down the street, very broad chested, you know, looking jacked, a lot of tattoos. Like that's just what comes to mind when I think of the word power. Can you expand a little bit on power? What are things that people can do to feel powerful? Because I imagine it's probably much more simplistic than many would think.
I think so. You know, I think feeling powerful at base is feeling good about yourself and able to enact yourself in the world. You know, put simply, that's really what it is. So the guy walking down the street who looks really powerful, he could be either one. He could be a guy who is feeling like, yeah, I feel really good about me. And I happen to be jacked and walking down the street, but that's not necessarily what drives that sense of power. Then there can be another guy just like it who's doing it to try to fight off some bad feelings. So self-acceptance is not easily won. I tell people this all the time. you know, have patience with yourself to work at accepting who it is you are. And, you know, that's why those subtle moments are so important. You got to jump in and say, now, wait a minute, why was I apologizing for that? Or why do I feel in conflict about this? When I started, actually, this is interesting in relation to the first question you asked me with men and women. When I first started being a therapist, I was very, you know, there were five therapists in our, five therapists, there were five men in our class, and probably 25 women. And, you know, you could say, hey, great dating odds. but I also felt this thing of like, this challenge to my masculinity or maleness that I was choosing a profession that more often than not men did. And I kind of had to work that through. So now I don't have any problem with it whatsoever. And I long ago haven't, but we have to work through these things. I don't even know if I answered your question. I started rambling.
No, that's fine. It makes me think of when I was a junior in college, I took a principal, it was a public relations class, but I remember walking in and, I mean, there might have been, it was a much smaller, it wasn't a lecture class, it was a application. So it was like 25 people in the class, and I bet there were three guys or four guys, and I was one of them. But then I took my senior year, which, duh, for this one in terms of the male to female breakdown, but I took a women's studies class, and there was 100 people in the lecture hall, and I bet there was four of us that were, and it was at 7:30 in the morning, and it was from a very intense professor. It seemed a lot of times like it was like a hate on men class, but, you know, it's not that we have not had our sins over the last, you know, 500 years of living, but it's not here nor there. So
yeah, we probably need to go back further than 500 years, but otherwise I agree.
I mean, come on. I was just talking to somebody the other day that if I were to say, hey, what year was 30 years ago? The answer is always 1970. So, like, you know, concept of time isn't really there anyway.
Oh, I totally agree. I can't get used to the fact that
1990 was 30 years ago. Yeah,
that blows my mind. I mean, I remember when Octung Baby was 25 years old, and I was like, what?
We have a babysitter that's 26, and I'm being facetious usually, but there's been a few times since we met her years ago that, like, you know, she would make a comment about the year she was born or something like, oh, I was in sixth grade when that song was popular, something like that. So now sometimes, like when Eminem performed at the, I think it was at the Oscars a couple weeks ago, and I'm a big mark for Eminem. And I had just said that, like, I was like, there was this guy, you might have read about him in your history books, named Eminem, who was a rapper, and he was from Detroit. You know, so I do a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then there was one thing where I asked Alexa a few weeks ago, I was like, Alexa, play, usually my go-tos are, oh, she's reacting right now as I say that. I will usually say most of the time 90s R&B or 90s alternative. Those are most of the time what I want to listen to. And if I'm going to be calling upon her. And I had said 90s R&B, and the immediate snapback response from Alyssa, the babysitter, was, ooh, the classics.
Yeah, you know what? Oldies stations now. Oldies stations play 90s.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, no, that's not oldies. If you want to play oldies, you play the 1950s.
Yeah.
That's oldies. We need a new term, you know?
Yeah, but the classic rock station here is 102.5, and I have it on. If I'm in the car and I'm at a place, like sometimes, like if I'm like driving through a lot of forestry, I don't get satellite radio and I don't have cell reception or something. I drive a lot for work. But that station, because it's terrestrial radio, the waves just come in a little bit differently. And it was playing Dave Matthews stuff from like 2000.
So. Yeah. Those are the classics. Oh my God. Nothing will make you feel older than pop culture references that are, you know, telling you that you're old.
Right. There's it's on Netflix now, but if you haven't watched it, you should. But CNN did, they did it for the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. I have no concept of the 70s. The 80s, they were getting to the end of the decade when I was born, basically. And then, but the 90s I remember, the 2000s I really remember. But they would do like an entire hour show on, you know, the political climate in the 2000s. And they do one on like TV and radio in the 2000s and then music in the 2000s. And it's on Netflix and it is fascinating to take a look at.
That sounds fascinating. And the 80s are, that's my 90s for you.
Yeah.
It's, it's when it all started coming together in terms of, all right, what's going on here?
And, yeah. And
the music of then was kind of my music, still is. It's that sounds like a fascinating show. I'll definitely check that out.
So I'm down to the final three things that I wanted to talk about. One of them's more of just, hey, this is interesting because you're remind me, you're from New York, right?
I'm actually originally from Cleveland, Ohio.
So you're back now, but you spent some time in New York.
I lived in Brooklyn for 15 years.
And what was the year range for those 15?
My age range?
No. From what year to what year?
2004 to 2019.
So the episode that I just aired 2 days ago was with she's actually a local TMS therapist, doesn't call herself a TMS therapist, but that's how I found her. She's on the PPD website, and that's how I came across her. Dr. Serena Sterling, I don't know if you know her name, but she was working in magazine, went to school for journalism, and was working in New York City in magazine in 2001. She'd just come back from was studying abroad in Manchester and was living in New York. Got in the subway, or smartphones weren't around. The plane had hit the First World Trade Center, and she got in this, that's just the word on the street that she had heard was that something had hit the World Trade Center. She got in the subway, and then the subway stops where it wouldn't normally stop, and the doors open, and it's completely white, total whiteout, like can't see anything. And it was because the first tower had collapsed. And she said, it was basically that day her symptoms all started. Nervous system just out of whack. She said it was like, said it was just something that was so, and I had thought of you when she was telling that story and wondering if you were there in 01, but not quite.
My brother was living there at the time. And actually my dad, the one who adopted me and now is my dad, was actually in the third building that fell. He got out.
Oh, wow.
But I actually didn't even know he was there. So this is really interesting because I didn't know. He lives in Cleveland. He has business trips in New York, but I had no idea he was there. I only found out later. And so my nervous system in relation to him didn't get out of whack. But 9/11 sent us all out of whack. I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I watched. I remember that was a Tuesday, and the Wednesday, I just watched. I kept watching the planes impact the building. It could not stop. I think we were all affected by it.
I still can't stop. If National Geo TV or something has a special on, I'm still glued to the TV all these years later. And, but I just thought it was, and she has, she developed a variety of symptoms, but it's interesting because she has an autoimmune, she has rheumatoid arthritis, and actually had said that, her posture is a little more closed in. And she had said that she was in a really healing relationship at one point in time, and her posture completely she centered, and that her symptoms went into remission during that period of time. And so it's actually the first time that somebody's come on here and made the leap that, because Sarno very explicitly in his work says that rheumatoid arthritis and TMS are not the same thing. But she had said that may be true. However, you can have a cessation of symptoms in something like an autoimmune disease by doing this type of work. And she feels like she's a really good poster child for that because she has it and she can say that.
I think that's so important and so great. And also what you were saying about 9/11, it made me think, safety really is what's at issue. And when we have TMS, we don't really feel safe. We feel like our body is rebelling against us. Nothing feels safe. And 9/11 was one of the most unsafe feelings we could have. And safety comes in feeling connected with the self and at peace, or connected with the world and at peace, and all kinds of different safeties. Anyways, I just want to say that.
Well, and it could blast off into a whole nother episode, but there's big stories in the news as we speak. And by the time this airs, I'll be curious to see where these stories are at. But the coronavirus thing at the moment, in fact, you had made the comment earlier that giving blind faith to something is really a poor way to go about it. And I think it was just yesterday or the day before yesterday where Trump had said something about coronavirus and, we should hope that it goes, like, it was just something that was just very unsubstantiated in the way that it was described, on how to really like eradicate it or get rid of it. There's a high school not too far from my house that shut down yesterday and today because there is a relative or somebody who lives with a teacher, who's sick with something. They're not going to get test results back for like 5 to 7 days, but like, So that's a big story right now. And this sort of lack of feeling of safety that a lot of people probably have as a result of it. But then also just the election in general, I feel like is such a, is something that's so triggering. And I guess that this actually leads kind of well into the next thing, which, you know, when a therapist, whether it's you or anybody else, says to feel your feelings, I would like to get a response on A, what does that mean to you? And then two, how do people do it? But ultimately, you know, the whole concept of like the, all these triggering things, the coronavirus or watching old videos on 9/11 or the, you know, the president saying something dumb or a candidate saying something dumb or Bloomberg out there and having 68 women accuse him of sexual assault. Like there's all these things that can be triggering. And the thing is like those things will never go away. So they're always going to be there. So how can people manage them? So part one, what does feeling your feelings even mean and how do people do it? And then part two, the trigger conversation. How can we make it so that they don't impact us and cause symptoms to come back up or flare back up?
Excellent questions, as always. You know, I think that, first of all, when I think about having feelings, ultimately, a successful job of having feelings is linking up intellect and emotion. And the reason I say it that way is often we can feel feelings in one area but not the other. We can be aware of what we think about something, but we're not really attuned to what we're feeling, and that's usually in the body. And then other times we can have a feeling, could be in the body or it could be, you know, kind of more pure emotion, I guess I would say, anger or sadness, even though that's going to be in the body too. But we don't know what it's linked to. So if we're really talking about having feelings effectively, we need to link the two. So sometimes we need to think about the intellectual side and process it enough that we can get to the physical and visceral and emotional side of it. Other times we can, like with TMS, be having a physical event and we need to link it to intellect. Now this gets me to, this is answering your second question, but pulling it into the first question. How do we do that? How we do that really comes from the fact that we need to understand our own story. I'm a big believer in the fact that we all have a narrative about ourselves. And we have to understand how things fit into our story. So if something's triggering, we can't just think, oh, yes, sexual assault is triggering. Of course it is. But why? And when I say why, I don't mean like it makes no sense that it is. But I mean there are specifics. There's specifics about you. This is where that depends rule is really good. We get specific about it. So for some people, some people could be triggered by, I mean, actually when Kobe died, there was a lot of, I think you talked a little bit about this in the episode before I went on, about the fact that some people, you know, had a lot of response to that he could be a triggering figure. And then for other people, it's this, and for many people, it was this devastating and surreal horror, and for some it was even both. But it's going to depend on the specifics of the person. You know, some people might have had the experience of being assaulted and then they never told anyone, so maybe the triggering thing for them would be a person who never told or never felt it was okay. For other people, maybe they told someone and they weren't believed, so then the not believing thing would be triggering. When the Kavanaugh hearings were happening, I was in a daze for like 3 days afterwards. And it was because it felt similar to some things that had happened to me, you know, where, look, this is just my opinion and I don't know the facts about that. So I don't want to get too political here, but I felt that, I'm blanking on her name, the woman who testified. That tells you something too. I can't even remember her name. I apologize about that, but it'll come back to me. But she, whatever you believe, I found it very hard to believe that she would stand up there and just be telling a lie for no reason. You know, could there be some different interpretations of what happened? Okay, I don't know. But she seemed credible to me. And so to see a credible person saying something bad happened and then just having it totally dismissed, that hit me hard.
Yep.
So I feel horrible that I can't remember her name. And, you know, it's not that I don't remember it. It's that it shows you how difficult that experience actually was for me. I couldn't remember it. All I can remember is Kavanaugh, you know.
Well, I mean, that's it. It's not the same thing, but that's it's reminiscent of like a mass shooting happens. You know, we know the names of the people that commit the acts, but not necessarily the victims.
Right. Yeah. Actually, it's interesting because with 9/11, I was at a U2 concert and they were playing.
Blasey Ford was her name, by the way.
Right, Christine. Right. Unbelievable. But I remember, and it was shortly after 9/11 because it was actually at the 2002 Super Bowl. It was the only Super Bowl I ever went to, which was like a childhood dream of mine. And they were playing, I think it was Where the Streets Have No Name, but they were listing all the victims of 9/11. And I remember thinking, look at one of them and don't forget. So there was a guy named Paul Acquaviva right at the beginning of the list. I had no idea who he was. Haven't done any research even to find out who he was, but it was a way that I connected to. And so I think it's interesting that I couldn't remember Christine Blasey Ford. That's triggering for people.
Yeah.
You know, these events. And so the way that we deal with triggers is to know our narrative. You know, I think the reason it bothered me that I couldn't remember her name is that in my own story, I felt I was forgotten, you know, and not to mention that I also had to change my name when I was adopted. I didn't particularly like that. So we have to know the specifics of our story. And when we know that, we can get to peace about it, you know, and we can recognize that, you know, we can't give the triggering people the power. What we can do is reclaim that power by saying, I can know my own narrative. I can be at peace with me and what I've done.
It's making me blast off just to another question, and this is going to be the selfish side of me that I have this kind of access and not everybody does, but it's making me think of, because we're talking about these triggering events. My best friend was in the military, in the Army as an interrogator, and their best friend had died in a helicopter crash in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Kobe story happened, I'm texting back and forth in group chats and stuff like that about it, and just saying like, I, you know, I'm a girl dad, right? So I can empathize. I don't know why it impacted me to the way to which it did. Like I can't at the, I haven't given too much thought into why that is, because I mean, we don't have the NBA in Seattle. Like it's, you know, so like having that kind of a connection, I saw him play one time. I do know that really if you're one of the top five in anything, whether it's sales of something or you were one of the top five best Home Depot store managers of all time, like, you know, that's pretty awesome, right? Whatever it is.
Yep.
But when we were talking about the ways to which it happened, the helicopter crash, with Kobe and Gianna and the rest of the victims. And I had just said, I cannot imagine being in a helicopter with Zoe or Audrey that last moment before impact when like, you know, it's going bad and you have to be in such a place to where you can tell, Gianna, right, and whoever else is in there that like either tell them it's going to be okay or however it is that you react. And this friend of mine had just said like, we can talk about like how much we, you know, loved him or liked him, whatever. I can't talk about the circumstances to which it happened. I cannot, like,
I cannot
and will not. So at that point I was sort of at a loss of what to say.
Yeah.
So I guess in an instance like that, like even just as like a friend, but I guess as a therapist too, because there may be instances where something like this comes up. How do you even respond where it's like, I totally can get why, but it's a trigger and it's making you feel a certain way. I mean, what's the way to respond to somebody in that situation other than to just, I mean, I just stop talking about it. But ultimately there's something there that is still very bothersome and I completely understand why. I don't know. I guess what's your commentary on a situation like that?
I want to make sure that I got the question right. So redirect me if I didn't. But what I focus on is staying present. Because what happens for people who have been through pain, and I think this happens with TMS, is people don't stay present with them. They don't want to experience it. It's too painful. It's like with the Kobe thing. When we imagine that, it's so horrifying that we can't. And I think our jobs, as best we can, is to, at least in that moment with that person in pain, be there with them. Now, they may not want us there with them, and that's okay. You know, if they want to drive us away at that point or they want to change the subject, I let that happen. But I always let them know I'm here. Even if it's a little uncomfortable, I say, listen, you know, a lot of people can't stick with pain. A lot of people can't do that, but I'm here. I can do that. So if you want to talk more about it, you can. If I did something that triggered you or upset you, I want to hear about it. You know, so if we can just be there to listen, that I think is what we want to do. Did I answer what you were wondering about?
Yeah. And I think, it's such like, those kind of situations are such anomalies. It's not every day that I'm going to have a very close friend of mine who had somebody very close to them pass away in the way to which a major celebrity also passed. I mean, helicopter right. crashes on the news are very uncommon unless it's a military story. It seems like, I mean, I couldn't even yep. tell you the last time that a non-military related helicopter crash other than Kobe Bryant was a big story on the news.
Yeah, I can't think of one offhand.
Okay. So, this is a weird way to sort of wrap this up, but it's something that's been swimming around in my brain and it's related to demographics again. But a little bit different. Earlier I had, asked about why do you think 70% of the listening audience is female? I'm a part of a multitude of TMS chronic pain communities. So meaning that these are the people that are aware of Dr. Sarno and all the work that surrounds this stuff. So not the people that are still, you know, getting the injections and don't even buy into that. So there's probably between all the different resources, I bet there's, I don't know, 5,000, 6,000 people between these different groups and networks and such. One thing I've been wondering about lately, and you know, we have a few minutes, so if you want to give a longer take, that's fine, but it's a weird question to ask. I notice a very, very small, because I'm the one that's in charge of letting these people into the group. I have screening qualifying questions because I don't want a dietitian coming in and trying to sell supplements to people that are in the group. So I have screening questions that involved like, have you read this book? What's your concept? How long have you been in pain? What's your level of belief? You know, all this kind of stuff to really screen out them.
Yep.
It is extremely rare that I get anybody that's applying to be or wants to be a part of these communities that is not a white person. And it's something I've been thinking about. There's no contingent of, at least not on a large scale, there's onesie twosies of African-American people, as an example, that try to enter these groups. And I think about this kind of thing and I'm just like, I wonder if, is there some kind of a stigma in certain types of cultures to where trying to, experience this kind of stuff or go this type of a route just is not accepted, and that's just the simplicity of it? Or is there something else? I mean, you've been practicing a while, you know this world. Is that something that is that been what you've seen as well? People that know about the stuff or will seek help in this way just don't tend to be, you know what I mean? Like it's a strange thing that I've just been thinking about the last couple of months that I've observed.
Again, fascinating question. I don't know that I did a great job answering the gender question, and I want to keep talking about it. But I'll just make a couple of observations, and then we can keep having a discussion about it. I mean, I do think that there are varying degrees to which different cultures are accepting of therapy. Certainly, I think, you know, a kind of upper middle class white community tends to be a baseline kind of community that tends to go to therapy. Or, you know, I'm Jewish, so like Jews, it's like I feel like we were born into therapy. but it's interesting. I find a very different thing happens when I just talk to people about these issues, and it's not about therapy or even emotions. When it's just about the facts of science, things like that. I'll tell you, I don't know why this is. Well, I have a theory about it, but the most accepting community of the TMS ideology is African Americans. I don't get a lot of them coming into my office, though. So I think some of it's about how comfortable are different groups interfacing in certain ways. You know, maybe, I don't know, but maybe an online presence talking about these things, maybe white people feel that we have that kind of a greater safety in society, which I think we do, unfortunately. I mean, not unfortunate that we feel safe, but unfortunate that other people don't. So I wonder if the online aspect is what shifts that some, but it could be a more therapy and emotion related thing. But I will tell you, when you tell an African-American person that, guess what, the establishment got this all wrong and they're not doing well by you, that might be the first community that would agree and be open to it.
I mean, part of that would make me wonder. One of my favorite movies, and this is another one of the ones that every time it's on, there's really three movies that every time they're on TV, I will stop and watch them almost in entirety every time. There's Titanic, there's Speed with Keanu Reeves, and then, and I guess Dennis Hopper, I think, is in that, Sandra Bullock, all that. But Straight Outta Compton is another one. And maybe it's because I'm a Cali kid at heart and I'm a Tupac NWA guy, and that was my thing. Like, that's my music. And so, but all of NWA's music was about fighting the establishment, that, you know, the way to which law enforcement, the way to which the government sort of treats we as a people, meaning the people that they're talking about in their songs, is completely wrong and the antithesis of how the world should be. Do you think that maybe that goes hand in hand with your example a minute ago where, hey, this whole thought that we had, it's totally wrong?
I think so. I think so. I have found, I don't know if I mentioned last time, but I actually taught in Compton. I did Teach for America. And so I've had a lot of different experiences, especially with the African American community. And I've learned a ton from them just listening to what's your experience. One of the things that I've reflected on a lot is that I always thought of myself as a good, strong ally, but it's like with pain. I wasn't listening deeply enough. I wasn't listening deeply enough to, like, what is it really like for you? I mean, I can walk out on the street. I'm a white person, and I'm a white man. I have very little to be afraid of in the same way that, like, a black woman would, or a black man. It's, you know, I think that there's these secrets that we don't get to talk about. It's interesting because, like, PC language tells us what not to talk about. But I think that there's also ways in which we all have these deep secrets that are known. We know them. You know, like, should there really be an argument over whether there's white privilege? It's kind of absurd to even. And look, there are people who will argue that it doesn't exist, which is insane to me. But there are these secrets that we carry, and when we carry secrets, they can be shaming. And I think that it can be a shaming experience to not be accepted by people, even when you know there's no reason for it. And so I think the mistrust of the establishment is well-placed mistrust for African Americans, as far as I'm concerned. And I think we need to do a better job of listening, whether it's the African American population, whether it's women, whether it's people who are in pain, because a lot of times people in pain are getting labeled as, oh, you're just a complainer, or no, it's real. And I'll tell you, nothing hurts worse than TMS. Nothing. If you're having really bad pain, it's probably TMS.
Yeah, I remember when I dislocated my shoulder. We're talking a major joint out of its socket. Hurt far less than any spasm I had in TMS. It wasn't even close.
Yep.
And I know that Sarno always, you know, he would say in all of his books that it's the most painful thing in medicine that he ever found was
I mean, my back was, and I've had women who have given birth to children who have actually said TMS is more painful than giving birth to children. I'm not, I want to say women, I'm not saying that I know that. I know nothing about it, but there are actually some women who say that.
Dan, we are at 2 hours. Hard to believe.
Yep.
We certainly went across a lot. Is there anything that you are thinking that wasn't said, or anything else that you want to, as we kind of wrap up in the last couple of minutes here, before I let you go, that maybe didn't get talked about?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm a talker, so I could go on and on and on. And so where things unsaid is always going to be the case. It's a pleasure talking with you, and if you'll have me back again, I'd love to do it. But I think what I've, it's not so much that I feel like something wasn't said as so much as I wanted to, just in reflecting on what it is that I said and hopefully got across, is kind of the center point of things, that the connection with self is so important, and answering your questions, your own doubts, is so key. And I think that that's true whether we're talking about TMS or something else. I want to be a force in this world that helps people be themselves. And what I do with that is, when I see someone being themselves, I tell them I like it. That I'm glad they feel comfortable doing it. When I see people who can't do it as much or feel that they can't do it, I encourage them to do it. So, you know, I've got some basic rules of thumb in terms of how to do things. But at base, you need to think about what is your narrative, because that is going to determine how your mind is, and that's going to determine how your body is. Much more to say.
Yeah, no. And I'm sure we're going to do this again. In fact, I'm thinking that this 2 hour episode is going to be split into back to back weeks. I don't even know what I'm going to call them, because if I call the first of this two parter Dr. Ratner part two, meaning a follow up from the one we did a couple months ago, then what is the next one? Is it part three? Is it? So I'll figure it out. But Dr. Ratner, thank you again so much for your time and for joining us for these two, it'll be three total episodes of, we'll just say 3 weeks. But yeah, remind us how people can find you. You know, can they get in touch with you if they like what it is that you're saying? If they're a guy that's listening to this and says, man, I'd really like a guy to talk to, how do they get in touch with you? That kind of stuff.
Absolutely. the easiest way to find me is on Psychology Today. You know, it connects to my email. You can get through me by phone. But I'm happy to give out whatever contact info people need. Because I always want to help people get to the place they need to go, even if I can't see them personally, I want to make sure. But Psychology Today is really the easiest way.
All right. Well, that that wraps it up. Dr. Ratner, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much for having me, Eddie. It's always a pleasure. It didn't feel like 2 hours to me. I could talk to you forever.
I agree.